Anyway, I haven't ever wanted to talk about sex before, mostly because there's not much to say. Just be kind to each other, and that's it. It happened that someone gave me a copy of Thich Nhat Hanh's version of the third precept, which the San Francisco Zen translates as "Don't misuse sexuality." And Thich Nhat Hanh's version so inflamed me that I felt I had to say something. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh, of course, as you know, is a very respected and revered Buddhist teacher. His writings are very deeply moving. They're very deep and loving. In fact, his latest book, The Heart of Buddhist Teachings, which I happen to be reading now, I just found myself in reading it impressed anew with him and deeply affected. You know, he obviously thinks very widely and cares enormously about human suffering. There's no doubt about this. In fact, his book that I just talked about is specifically about suffering and connection, which are two topics closest to my heart. That's what I usually lecture about in different guises all the time. He's very involved in helping and comforting and easing human beings. He's devoted his life, his entire life, to us all. And the reason I'm praising him so is I don't want anything that I have to say about his interpretation of sexual disability to be misconstrued as a lack of respect. I respect Thich Nhat Hanh very deeply. But I have to come from my own place. I can't just mouth the teaching of great Buddhist teachers, of great Buddhist teachers. My sexual karma is very different from Thich Nhat Hanh. And so I have a different point of view. I'll read the precept that I'm talking about to you. This is the third precept. And it's from his book, called For a Future to Be Possible, Commentaries on the Five Wonderful Precepts. So the third precept is about sexual responsibility, and it goes like this. Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I vow to cultivate responsibility and learn ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment. To preserve the happiness of myself and others, I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. So, of course, you know, his admonitions about sexual responsibility and children and preventing couples and families from broken up, of course, that's very important. And I think as Buddhists, we must respect that. But my objection is to this sentence, I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment. Now, I think this is all very well for celibate monks, for people in their dotage who are past sexual desire, and for people who have found satisfying monogamous relationships. But I don't think that expressing the third precept in this way is helpful for young people, whose sex drive is very strong. I don't think it's helpful for people who enjoy casual sex. And I don't think it's helpful for people who see sex as a realm of self-exploration, like art or psychological construct. In fact, I think sex is a lot richer as a means of self-exploration than art or psychological construct. For one, it usually takes one other person, at least one other person, and it elicits the strongest attachments known to human beings. And it also is utterly revelatory of your delusions if you pay close attention. I think it's true that for many people, love and long-term commitment is the best factor for sexual relationships. For one, you can trust another person with your body and with your vulnerability. And that's a very good thing. And also within the confines of an intimate couple, a committed couple, you can explore your sexuality maybe with more ease than if you're just running around with different people. You can relax more and explore all your desires within the safety of this relationship. So I don't think that you have to be a romantic to give romantic love its due. I think it deserves a lot of respect. Sex is an expression of love and commitment between human beings. It is again one of the most wonderful things that human beings can experience. But I don't think monogamy is the only way. In less permissive societies than ours, people get married very young because that's the only way to have sex. And they also don't put onto their couples the same thing we do. I mean, they don't think that they have to be in love and get along with this person. Their roles are very defined. And it may be that when people in those societies get married very young, they don't explore sexuality for a long time. Or women have problems. They're not allowed to express that. And sex seems more of a procreative thing, whereas we have many manifestations of it. And even in this society, I'm not in favor of people marrying young. I know it works for some people, but I know for many people, you're a very different person at 25 than you are at 50. If you have any idea of spending your life with another person, it's very unusual that that person would develop in the same way that you would. So I tend to favor later marriage for people. But of course, always exists. But I think when you're 20, even in this society, when you're not allowed to have sex outside of a commitment, that you'll practically do anything to have sex, and that you'll think, well, I'll worry about the incompatibility after down the road. Right now, the important thing is to get laid. So I think that they're all different. You know, we don't all wish to become confined to one relationship, or even one gender. And first off, before I really launch into this, I want to make clear my own prejudices and inclinations. I have tremendous respect for and affection for the sex drive. In fact, it was my first teacher and most enduring teacher. When I was a young woman, I was born in 1942, so came to sexual maturity in the 50s. And when I was a young woman, I was interested in and proficient at many things. I was educated. I got a master's degree in physiological psychology. And right off the bat, as soon as I got out of school, even in the competitive region of Boston and Cambridge, I got a great job right away working with B.F. Skinner at Harvard. Even though there was a lot of competition for jobs like that, and it's been that way all through my life. My career and job realm has always been wonderful. I know for some people that's the source of a great deal of suffering, but it never was for me. For me, great realm of suffering was sex. And it's the only reason as a young woman that it even occurred to me to start becoming conscious. Because it created so much suffering for me. It was tremendous. Well, first of all, as I said, I came to sexual maturity in the 50s, so I was taught to believe that I should get married before I had sex. So I kept getting engaged over and over again. In these horrible situations, I even got engaged to two men at the same time. And this was actually in that situation, it was because I was in graduate school and I discovered that I needed sexual release regularly to continue things. And so the man I was having an affair with or having relations with insisted on getting engaged after a while, and even though I was engaged to somebody back home, I had to do it. Anyway, that was the most suffering I ever caused. That was really terrible. And as you can imagine, I mean, it caused everyone tremendous suffering, even with my family that I was with his fiance. I can't even believe it. But I realized that I had to do something. So I started doing, you know, trying different strategies besides having to get married. Well, eventually I just had to leave town. As a young woman, I thought, well, I won't make marriage. I mean, I realized actually wasn't so interested in marriage. But I thought that eventually I would be, but I never was. And so what happened is I thought, well, I'll have sex, but I will, you know, have a committed relationship when I have sex. Well, what happened with that strategy is that every time I was attracted to someone and slept with them, I would fall in love with them because I had the two linked. And this was terrible because sometimes the person wouldn't fall in love with me. And I was with unrequited love. I was just bereft, even though I had been roused to love. And other times we would fall in love with each other, so that worked out, but we were entirely incompatible. I mean, in fact, it turns out that people I'm most attracted to, I'm just not compatible with over the long term. I mean, I'm attracted to wild men, crazy, you know, outlaws. And you can't, you know, raise children in Sherwood Forest with a sheriff. Anyway, that didn't work out. And after some years of tremendous suffering under that strategy, I just thought, that's it. I've had it. I'm just going to have sex whenever I desire it. And I'm just going to not have relationships. I can't handle love. So I'll just try sex. Well, by this time, it was the mid-60s. So historically, I was at the right time. I mean, I could. It was very easy for me to just go over to the Cambridge Common on the Sunday rock concert and just say, "Hey, you." And, you know, unlike today, it was also a very safe time. I mean, I wasn't in too much danger of inviting serial killers back to my apartment because we were all kind of innocent. And so that turned out to be the worst strategy of all. I mean, I just am not the type. I mean, it's just, what would happen is I would have sex and then ask the person to leave, or the next morning or whatever, and then I would just feel lonely. So I wasn't temperamentally suited for casual sex, or that level of casual sex, but men loved it. Even so, I would come back from wherever I was, and there would be a guy sitting on my steps, you know, and then there would be somebody else arguing with the privilege to just sit on my steps. By the time I got to Zen Center, which was in my late 20s, I was interested in just two things, sex and enlightenment. And since I didn't know anything at all about enlightenment, that continued to be my greatest teaching. And when I was a young student at Tassajara, which is Zen Center's monastery in Big Sur, I was asked to be the guest cook in the summer. And Tassajara is very hot in the summer, and being in the kitchen was very uncomfortable, so I wore as little as possible. I wore shorts and a camisole without underwear. And sometimes during breaks, I would go to the swimming pool in my clothes and come back to the kitchen sober, and I would be comfortable until my clothes dried. Well, after a couple of weeks of this, Baba Roshi, who was my teacher, called me in, and he was very angry, and he said, "If you don't put some clothes, I'll kick you out of Tassajara." So I was very offended. First of all, you don't have to threaten me to make an impression. And secondly, I thought, well, I threw off this prudery a long time ago. What if I don't want to be associated with some organization that is, you know, back in 1910 or something like that. And when I told him this, he said, "It's not just prudery. It's you." He said, "It's your body, your sex life, your invasion into other people's space with your sexuality." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Yes." He said, "When you came to me right after Sri Roshi died and asked me to be your teacher, as Suzuki Roshi's Dharma heir, he said, "You were so sexy and flirtatious, I couldn't believe it." I said, "Really?" And I thought, I didn't know that. And he said, "What's the first thing you think of when you look at me? What's your first perception?" And I said, "Well, I think I wonder whether they'd be a good special partner." Mm-hmm. He said, "Right, everybody knows that you think that." Oh my God. Oh my God. I said, "No wonder I've always had such trouble in my life." And that was my first insight, and it was a crash insight. But if my reality was very narrow, or my perceptions were very narrow, my reality would be narrow. And I didn't understand, as a new student, that suffering actually starts with perception, how you organize the world. What is your agenda, your deep agenda, and how you project that onto the world? That was my first understanding. Well, I went out of that meeting just reeling the possibility here. The fact that I might be able to control what happened intellectually was really tremendous information. And as a matter of fact, so anyway, after that I started practicing looking at people as human beings. You know, looking into a person's face, what are they about, what is male and female. And as a matter of fact, when my boyfriend and I went out of Tassajara for Christmas vacation, we came up to the Bay Area and got together with another couple that we had been friends with, except with this other couple, the man had always been a little uncomfortable around me, and I never understood why. But in this instance, when we got together at Christmas time, he was very relaxed with me. And I realized I had probably put him on edge with my well, that just, I felt drunk with power, that I could actually determine how a person felt about me sexually, and that I could actually have relationships with people that didn't have that charge on them. I know this seems elementary, but it never had occurred to me before that it was possible to live in a neutral space. I get home with, you know, very sexually charged. So anyway, that was a huge insight, that my reality could be broader than just sexuality. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, sex is the chief expression of craving. It causes our sex. Craving causes our sex. And sex is the epitome of pure craving. Not only does it override everything in its way to sexual satisfaction, but sexual satisfaction creates more craving, at least when you eat. You're full. But if, with sex, it's not that way. If you have bad sex, then you keep trying until you have good sex. And if you have good sex, you say, "This is great, I gotta do this again and again and again." So sex, unlike other cravings, just creates more and more craving. Now the aim of Buddhist practice is the cessation of craving. And in the Buddhist view, there's nothing inherently wicked about sex, as there is in our Judeo-Christian tradition. The failure to be kind in the sexual realm is neither better or worse than the failure to live up to any other people. It's not a more serious offense, sexual failures. Buddhism does not get involved in whether sex is wicked or indulgent. The problem for Buddhists is the attachments that rise out of sex, not sex itself, but the fact that it really creates attachment to the person you have sex with, to sex. There's nothing, in Buddhism, there's no other reason for sexual restraint than the prevention of suffering, of harm to other people, or of bringing unwanted children into the world. So why do I take issue then with this nothing word about sex only being appropriate in a committed relationship? Because as I said, I do think that intimate sex, sex as an expression of intimacy, is one of the most wonderful experiences humans can have. But I also believe in sexual experimentation. not only because it's the way that you might choose a long-term partner, for many of us, that is the case, that you'll experiment until you find a partner that you can commit yourself to. But I also think sexuality and sexual experimentation is a tremendous cultivator and developer of skillful means. Now, skillful means in Buddhism is how you manifest your belief, how you act in the world with skill. I mean, you might have all the idealism in the world. You cheat people in commerce, or you treat people badly. It has nothing to do with what you believe. So as a Buddhist, we develop skillful means. We consider how our speech and actions affect other people. And I think that you learn in sexual relationships how, as in no other relationships, how absolutely crucial honesty is. Absolutely crucial. The consequence of seducing someone with a false impression of yourself. Or editing when your lover says, oh, who did you meet? Oh, I met so-and-so, leaving out the attractive person that you were meeting. And I also think that sexuality is a tremendous opportunity for cultivating the ability to observe your own desires and to temper desire right in the middle of tremendous when it's necessary to prevent suffering. I also think that sexuality is the ideal medium to learn to recognize and satisfy one's own needs while respecting other people's needs just as much. And I do think this comes down to one of the basic arts of living. Not how to satisfy your own needs, not only sexually, but your need for love and admiration, for creativity, for a way to support yourself. If you can learn how to satisfy those needs for yourself while still giving as much credence to somebody else's needs for all that, that's pretty skillful. That's a pretty skillful life for you. But we need some way to learn. And I have a quotation from a book. Celeste West, who is a librarian, who's our librarian at Zen Center, wrote a book called Lesbian Polyfidelity, which is a Buddhist training manual for multiple relationships. Lesbian Polyfidelity. And she writes, we are all desire machines. With lovers, I really have to confront this and try to work out solutions. A lover's mirror may reflect me back or just my false images. It takes awareness and practice to know which is which. I like to find out how I make myself suffer, where I'm still stuck. I gradually expand my comfort zone as I learn to let go of how I think my lovers should be. If I don't stay completely present, I can be haunted by ghost lovers, trailing behind me, like the wake of a ship. By staying in the holy present, my ghost marauders are but awake. Surely a spiritual journey is to learn how to express love. Not misusing sex is a rule of training, like any other precept. It's an undertaking you take on, the third precept, for yourself and for others as well. As a Buddhist, you do your best to consider the circumstances of the situation you're in and not just charge at it. If you honor the third precept of not using sexual, misusing sexuality or taking sexual responsibility, if you honor it but worry that you can't live up to it, that you can't take care of it, then you do your best with great sincerity and effort. This is a tough precept about a tough craving. Sometimes you'll fail, sometimes you'll succeed, and you'll learn from it all if you take that as a guideline. The sex drive is very strong. In fact, my childhood hero, Bertrand Russell, who is an English philosopher and an anti-war activist, in his autobiography, he had 5 marriages and many mistresses. He had the same problem I did growing up in Ohio. He had 5 marriages and many mistresses besides, and he writes in his autobiography, not until his sex drive disappeared in the 70s to start to know happiness. So since sex is the epitome of craving, figuring out how to conduct yourself sexually, I think, is the epitome of Buddhist dream. So some people don't even consider sex as practice. Now, when I was a new student at Tathagata, I felt that way also. So there was all the zazen I was doing, and all the chanting, and all the Buddhist practices, and that was practice. And then sex was business as usual, you know, my usual delusion stuff. So my boyfriend and I got involved with this other couple, and they were senior students, and they seduced us. We were all four bisexuals, so it was a very rich relationship. And in fact, it was the most in love I've ever been. But, you know, it didn't stay four people equally loving each other because sex isn't that easy. My boyfriend and I were madly in love with the other woman, and her husband was in love with me. So, so they were much senior to us, and in fact, much longer. So the man said, "This is terrible. We have to include Baker Roshi in this." No. Said we have to tell him about it. Well, when he said that, I thought, oh no, no, we'll be kicked out of Tathagata. Because my only, you know, thought is that the principal will kick the bad kids out of school. I mean, I didn't see sex practice, but they did. The other couple definitely did. Anyway, Baker Roshi sat down with us, and much to my amazement, he just started talking about sexual practice, you know, how to take care of each other. In fact, he had some suggestions for us in tempering our desire while we were at Tathagata. He thought what we were doing was a city practice, actually, and that because we were part of a community, a monastic community, that we should be having forth from there. And so he actually gave us tips on how to temper this, which I found very useful. But what was really interesting was that sex, just like everything else, was part of practice. That was enormously expansive to me because it made me see that everything I did was part of practice. That there was no realm that wasn't practice. And so practice, instead of being a little purse I carried around, this is. And my life was just me. So how do we practice in the midst of very strong desire? And I think that we do have guidelines in Buddhism. There's a middle way. And Buddhism doesn't have either extreme puritanism nor extreme permissiveness. Oh, by the way, you already have, but I give you permission to relax and do something. Because I might go on and on. Oh my God, I just listened. So I think I have to eliminate a lot of this. No. Well, I'll tell you the guidelines, just no more stories.
No premature withdrawal.
Now that's my option. So how do we practice in the midst of tremendous desire? Now, as I said, Buddhism does not advocate either puritanism nor excessive permissiveness, but how do we know what that is? Well, how do we figure that out? It's not sufficiently helpful to just say the middle way between this and that. Because each is merely an inadequate reaction to the other. So what we have to do is map out a sane and compassionate course. Each one of us has to do this for ourselves, taking into account our desires, and other people that we come into contact with, because each situation calls for the appropriate response. You can't just whip out a policy. Now, actually, you can, to some degree, whip out a policy. Like if you're a celibate monk, for instance, that's a policy. No problem. But, or you might have, as I do, I'm not going to sit with my students ever. That's just the end of that. So, that's a policy. But that leaves a lot of other possibilities. and you have to determine in each situation what that is. What is the appropriate response in each situation? So you might have a combination of policy, or never slip, you know, a person who's married or whatever. So here's some guidelines. I think that the main guideline is mindfulness. Zazen and mindfulness. And I think that is not the only area in which mindfulness cultivate a mind that includes conscious awareness and compassion. This is a practice that cultivates this. So your job is to do this and be cultivated so that you can always bring your best into a situation, into this particular situation, not planning ahead necessarily, but you can understand that whatever comes up, you will meet it with this mind you've cultivated in Zazen. So I also have a quote. This is from an article by Nyo Lehi, whom I'm sure some of you know. He wrote an article called Pure at Heart, Dharma Practice and Self, which is printed in the book Queer Dharma. And he lists the four foundations of mindfulness. Body, so you're attending to sensation there. Feelings, whether it's you're chasing pleasure or averting from pain. States of mind, your emotion, anger, jealousy, desire. And mind content, concepts you make out of all this stuff. And by mindfulness, he says, one comes to discover how mental and physical phenomena arise and cease by paying attention to your body, feelings, states of mind, and the concepts you have. Slowly and patiently, we can disentangle by mindfulness all the complications of this. So this means become aware and clear about your motives in any particular situation. If the sex drive is acknowledged and understood, then the challenge is to remain aware and to strive to act consciously in the moment. And what we should be mindful of besides the four foundations of mindfulness is right speech and right action. And right speech, it isn't right in the sense that it's not wrong. It's not like, you know, Christianity where it's right and there's no other possibility. Right speech means in the sense of whole and healthy, conducive, having the consequences of compassion and a reduction of suffering. That's what right speech means. So again, consciousness, conscious awareness of your motives and desires, and compassion, so that you don't present a false self to entice other people. Don't lie. You reassure your lover, and your lover needs reassuring. You're kind to your lover, and you're honest. Because whatever you say creates tremendous consequences. The editing, for instance, that I mentioned earlier, is saying being true to the letter of honesty, but not the feeling of honesty. That's not right speech. And the right action, how you behave in the world. And I would like to quote Dogen's Benhua as translated by Okamura and our own Taigen Layton. It's called The Wholehearted Way in English. Bodhisattva vows are our direction in each moment. However innumerable all beings are, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible my delusions are, I vow to extinguish them all. However immeasurable the Dharma teachings are, I vow to master them all. However endless the Buddha's way is, I vow to follow it. So these four bodhisattva vows are the direction of our action. Since our delusion is inexhaustible, at no time can we eliminate all our delusions. Still, we try to do it moment by moment. And this trying itself is the manifestation of Buddha's way. You understand that you're always delusional. And therefore, you're careful. You make allowances for your delusion. Our practice doesn't eliminate our delusion, but to become aware of the fact that we are deluded. So then, when you acknowledge and respect your delusions, you aren't pulled around by them. In the same way as if you're pretending that you're a compassionate person at all times. We see the universe from the point of view of other people. We can only see from my point of view. We are limited as individuals, so each moment we see only part of the world, not the whole world, and that is the source of delusion. So, after right speech and right action, I think that when we do forge our own way sexually, it's when we have multiple relationships, or when we pursue casual sex, or we have a basic committed relationship, but we invite people into that relationship from time to time. I think that when we do that, we have to make rules about it. For instance, in a threesome, I think you have to decide whose orgasm is first. You know, just, again, this is subconscious and very aware and taking care of people. I think when you do invite people into a basic committed relationship, you need rules about what's the criteria, who's invited in, and on what basis. And I think you have to be very conscious and aware when you forge your own path sexually, meaning outside of the usual standards of this culture. So, the key here is to be conscious and acknowledge the attachments created by sexual expression. It's good for you to know what kind of person you are. Like I discovered, for me, casual sex is incredibly painful. You should know what kind of person you are. Sexual pleasure is like money. It's not, it itself is the root of all evil, but love of it is. To be attached to it. I'll stop soon. When my son was 14, he continued my sexual crime. But this particular incident, when he was 14, there was a girl that in his school that particularly called him all the time, bothered him all the time, tried to get him to date him and stuff like that, that he didn't care for. But then one time he came and told me, asked permission actually, because mother and she had called him and asked him would he like to go up to the Sierras to a cabin they had up there. And I said, well, absolutely not. You cannot go. And he said, why not? I'm just going to hang out in the woods. I said, you're going to have sex with her, aren't you? And he said, you're here. He said, it's none of your business, and I'll go if I want. And I said, okay. None of my business, and I just want to tell you, if you think this girl nags you now, I said, not only will she nag you twice as much, she'll have the right to do it. And he said, you get out of my life, I hate you, I don't know, terrible. But I did what I could do, I mean, there was nothing more I could do, and so a couple days later he came and he said, I just thought, you'd like to know, I decided. So all kinds of suffering are available in this realm. Jealousy, lying or being lied to, guilt, resentment, the vulnerability of the exploited, the alienation of the exploiter, helplessness in the face of infatuation, and when you do commit yourself to someone, thinking that that desire is unchanged, that has to always be in this little container, this little box, that you can't branch out. I don't mean to other people necessarily, but you can't try different things. So you can't really control desire. All you can do is dance with it. And sex is so volatile and so unpredictable that no matter how hard you practice it, you can't cover all the bases. And my last story will be about this disaster that I thought that I had all the bases covered. I lived at Green Gulch. I was an older student. I was Baker Roshi's Anja, which means his housekeeper. So he and I had a regular relationship. I saw him all the time. And I was at work meeting one day, and there was this absolutely gorgeous man there. He was new. He'd just come from the city center, Green Gulch. And the sun glinted off his hair and his arms. And I just thought, oh my God. But then I thought, no, I'm going to do it right this time. I'm just going to do it right. So I went to Baker Rush and I said, blah, blah. And I said, should I act on this or what? And he said, well, here's what you should do. you're afraid that you'll hurt him, right? Oh, he was younger than I, and a new student. So, you know, the recipe for disaster, right? Because here's what you do. You call up the city center and find out about his last three relationships and how they went. So I said, oh, this is brilliant. So I called up the office in the city, and the person who answered the phone knew everything. So she said, she gave me the last three relationships. They were all with older women. This is good. And she wasn't sure who'd broken up with whom, but he never seemed disturbed, right? I mean, he never seemed like he was depressed. She said the odds were good that he just, you know, ended the relationship. I said, great. So I told Baker Roshi, and he said, oh, this does look very good. He said, there's one more danger that you have to overcome. And he told me lots of stories of past sexual relationships between younger and older students, and he said, you'll probably be a teacher for him whether you want to be or not, because he'll put that on to you. But even if it ends badly, he said he will understand what it's like to have a relationship with an older student. And he said sometimes with broken hearts from this have left Zen Center and then come back because they never could find a relationship that was as present. That sounded good. So I began a relationship with this young man. And it just didn't turn out at all. I mean, it was so complicated and it's disastrous. For one, I never suspected what happened to me, which is we continued this relationship over the week. I guess it was a couple months. Something happened to me, and I got roused to love. I mean, because I was having sex, I got roused to love. I wanted to be in love, but he was so totally inappropriate to love. I mean, he was a very sweet boy, but he was just absolutely, I mean, like when I wanted to listen to the Rolling Stones, he'd say, but I thought you were so refined. He even asked me once, he said, what was all that fuss about in the 60s? You know, what was it? And he had been a hippie living out of his VW van, you know. I mean, it was very hard not to say, look, you live in that VW van because of me. Just shut up. Anyway, this was very trying to me. So after a while, I had to stop the relationship. I mean, what happened is I started, just like that time in Cambridge that I would just have casual sex, even though this was the same person, felt like that. I was to love, but there was no one to meet me. And so I just always ended up feeling depressed and alone. So I finally had to end it. And I ended it, I thought, very gently. In fact, I had no inkling that he was attached to me. Because he didn't know how to feed a woman emotionally. He never said to me, I really care for you, or gave me any gifts or anything. I mean, I never thought that he cared for me. He gave no indication. And when I ended it, he went to bed for a week and tried to commit suicide. They had to put somebody there. It seemed all to everybody hated me, said I was what a terrible person I was. Well, what a disaster. And so when I went to Baker Rush to talk about it, and I guess this is just a very strong thing. And you know what happened to him. So my point is that no matter how hard you try to practice, and I exhort you to practice very hard with sexuality, you can't pretend that you're covering the base. It is too strong. It's too unpredictable. So you must be very honest and conscious. So I'll leave you with a golden rule. Never let passion override compassion. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry to have kept you. If it's okay with you, I'll take two questions so I don't keep you. Yeah.
I like the song started this thing. You always talk about Christian sexuality.
Yes.
And your last line on the predictability process is a great sentence.
Yes.
I think that the employer says it is in some sort of proportion to what happens. The select ghosts, the two big ghosts of Mom and Daddy, for example, how can the other people be assessed? Because we don't know sometimes who we're loving, but we don't know the construct of garbage or clay or whatever. Because we don't know ourselves.
That's a big one. No, I think you're doing fine.
Until I can identify that, which seems to me these conditions matter, that you and I are watching the mother of something. I feel like that.
You mean until you...
Until I figure out who I'm supposed to find.
Well, I admire your restraint. I think that it's...
Thank you.
I think that that's one way to go. I think that it's just always in the formative stage. You know yourself better. You'll know yourself better in 5 years than you know yourself now. It's continuing to commit yourself to practice, And I think that commitment is very important because you need to penetrate things that are hard to look at about yourself. So if you care more about penetrating them than you do about your vanity or your thoughts about yourself, you will penetrate. So you have to keep committing yourself to practice the conscious awareness. So, and Zazen is important because it develops stability. The stability to look, oh, and then you flinch away because you can't stand what you see. Then you look. The stability develops the ability to keep looking with less flinching to find out who you are. Yeah. But isn't that part of the thrill? Another question?
You said you read through the Dharma.
Some of the chapters.
About quantum physics.
Your article.
Right. But I'm not Chris, because it seems to be the same area you're talking about. But for me, it seems like it may be very specific to sex. It doesn't seem like there is a sense that some sexual exploration is well, you know, like you described this young man you saw, that semi thinking was there. I mean, there was probably, that's some kind of basic thought I could have.
That's right.
Absolutely. You know nothing about that person, but right. That he could combine his archetype, and he wanted to respond to that.
Yeah.
And I think that form of sexual response is very different from sexual biology, with a intimate partner, that you know, that you could encourage you to put the archetype on it, because you know some basic kind of personality,
Right. So how would you define intimacy with a one-time lover, a one-night stand? What would intimacy be in the contact between those two people, casual sex?
I think it would be a sort of trying to share the joy of the
sexual experience. Yes, I think that's a very good definition. Because you actually do have a connection, a contact. In his article, Myo also said that he thought the only thing in Buddhism was the cultivation of alienation, because in Buddhism, we respect the interconnection between all of us. So I think that it's quite possible to connect to more the casual level in the way that you said. We both have that experience. Yes.
How do you reconcile consciousness of mindfulness with being out of control, controlling the doors, and just wanting to be in powers and gifts, something to maybe in that moment, or surrender, towards this, more to be intuitive, maybe just hold it for a gift? Do you reconcile that with being mindful?
Well, I think you can be mindful of being out of control. In fact, I think it enriches the experience, and then just, well, it takes some cultivation. I think that you're already sitting zazen, you're already studying mindfulness, and I wouldn't do it in order to have a sexual experience. I would just bring the self that does zazen and is mindful into sexual experience. It's not so different. That is your question. So, you're welcome. Pardon? Well, because you guys are being nice to me and laughing at my story, so it's fine now. Thank you very much.